This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nelly. Our guest this week is Ryan LeGrand, President and CEO of the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Ryan LeGrand of the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council next. America's 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers count on a strong U.S. sugar policy to keep American consumers supplied with an essential ingredient. Better yet, it's designed to cost taxpayers nothing. These farmers support more than 151,000 jobs throughout the sugar supply chain in both urban and rural communities. They contribute over $23 billion to the economy each year and help keep it sweet in America. Learn how the Farm Bill supports sugar crop farmers and workers at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. While celebrating the 65th anniversary of what was originally known as the U.S. Feed Grains Council, the group has a new name. Recognizing an expanding spectrum of grains and byproducts, Ryan LeGrand says the group is now known as the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council.
It really just brings into our identity in name something that's been our identity in practice for many, many years now. For 20 years, we've been promoting distillers' grains, and for the last 10, 11 years, we've been working to develop foreign markets for ethanol. So those two products are incorporated into the bioproducts addition to our name, but it's not just that. It's the high-pro distillers' grains that are now coming out of American ethyl plants, and it is made to hopefully encompass any of the future products that may be coming out of American ethanol plants that we don't even know about today.
Well, when you were noted as the Grains Council, you're working alongside the Renewable Fuels Association, Growth Energy, and others toward promoting biofuels, but it wasn't necessarily in your name, but it made sense that you would promote the value-added side of the business.
That's right. You know, we have great partners in the Renewable Fuels Association and Growth Energy and many others that these ethanol associations, state and national level. It does make sense because, biofuels, value-added products, biofuels and distillers' grains are something that our farmer members want to see us work towards developing markets on. You know, when you look at farmers' priorities, we consistently see that safety net, the crop insurance is their top priority. But number two is a lot of times trade, international trade, and within that number two priority is trade in value-added products. So the idea is create that value here in the United States, create the jobs in the United States, and export that value that we have to offer to the world.
Many have talked about the development of a bioproducts economy, a bioeconomy. So is there a identified array of what these bioproducts are now, or does it leave room for development?
I think it does leave room for development. We could have gone with the U.S. Grains and Ethanol Council or Distillers Council or something like that, but this really opens the door to what we're producing today, and then we're looking into sustainable aviation fuel. We've really staffed up and hired experts on that front to help us on policy overseas, to help with our technical understanding on it. So it opens the door to that. Also, sustainable marine fuel is something that's starting to pop up on a lot of folks' radars, and offering ethanol as a fuel to clean up the water, so to clean up the emissions coming from ocean-going vessels. And then what's to come? There's talk about using ethanol more in solvents. There's always been work for a long time on replacing petroleum products in plastics with biofuels, with ethanol as well. So I think it just keeps the door open and hopefully allows us, this name gives us staying power for many decades to come.
So if we open your menu, corn, sorghum, barley, renewable fuels, dried distilled grains, what's the whole menu now, and what opportunities are you seeing that really open the door for U.S. agriculture?
we do have quite the menu of products now. One of the biggest opportunities I think we see is continued growth in ethanol markets. Countries around the world are continuing to see the benefits of ethanol in terms of economics, in terms of air quality and GHG savings. We're seeing that show up in the exports. We're going to top this year, this marketing year that's going to close at the end of August, we're going to be over 2 billion gallons, about 2.1, 2.15 billion gallons of ethanol exports, and that's more than the United States has ever shipped outside of our borders before. Simply put, ethanol is one that we see as having continued growth prospects, and then as we get into SAF and potentially SMF or the marine fuel, it could really grow exponentially from there.
So how has the president's tariff action impacted your efforts in trying to open markets for U.S. farmers?
It's gotten countries' attention, that's for sure. We've seen delegation after delegation come to Washington to negotiate with the administration. We're talking to many of them as they come in because they know that the products offered or that developed and promoted by U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council are ones that can really contribute to right-sizing trade between our nations. And so, you know, we'll speak with them about corn, about barley, sorghum, distillers, grains, and ethanol, all of our products, and how they could fit into their markets and how they could potentially offer that to the administration as a way to help facilitate all of the trade deals that are going on. So it's been good to see lots of action here in Washington.
So some of the markets that we've heard could provide opportunity for ethanol, India, Japan, even the European Union. Is there such a thing as low-hanging fruit in this particular area?
You know, we think so. Nothing comes easy, right? But we see Vietnam as one that's opening to E10. We've seen actually their first pumps, pumping E10 at the gas stations there just last week. I saw the first pictures of E10 at their stations. Very exciting to see. That's around a 300 million gallon market that we do not have any of today. So that's one that I expect to really take off here in the future. Japan is transitioning to E10 by 2030. We're hoping they start moving at least the trials up to a little bit of an earlier date, but that's a billion-gallon market that doesn't exist today. We're very excited about those two markets. And then there's obviously others. India, it's been difficult to get fuel ethanol in, but we're still working hard on doing just that. Indonesia is another target, and we can't forget about Mexico. Mexico has recently developed a biofuels law that would allow for blends of between E6 and hopefully E10 someday. So some of the regulations are being written around that law that's just been passed, and we're excited and haven't given up on Mexico, even though just a few years ago they had an E10 policy that was unfortunately struck down by the high court. Their current president is interested in ethanol and knows the benefits of it, understands it.
So who are our competitors in trying to satisfy these markets for ethanol?
Brazil is really the only country out there that has major exportable supplies. India could potentially get there someday, but they're not there today. So we're looking at Brazil today as the main competitor, but they are exporting less as they consume more in-country. They've just moved to an E30 blend, so that's going to soak up more of their supply. They do have a booming corn ethanol industry that's really growing, and so that could put some more supplies on the market.
I thought it interesting back in the spring, actually during Commodity Classic, President Trump made remarks to farmers saying, get ready to produce more for the domestic market. And when I looked at opportunities for U.S. grains and certainly for oil seeds, outside of a major increase in exports, the only real driver that I could see would be renewable fuel. And, of course, we can use it here in the U.S., but that's a value added when you start to sell that around the globe.
Right, it really is. You know, we'd love to see E15 nationwide, year-round here in the United States, but here at the Grains and Bioproducts Council, we are focused on shipping it outside of our borders. You know, 97% of the world's population lives outside the United States borders. And so that's where your growth is going to come from, and that's where we're focused.
So let's look at the bulk commodities. Talk about how the world has changed. At one time, the U.S. was the major supplier of grains and of oil seeds. But now Brazil, now Argentina, the Black Sea region, where's our competition and where do we rate in the global supply chain?
Right. So we used to dominate, I think, upwards of, 70% market share in global exports. And that's really been chipped away over the years by the countries you just mentioned, as they expand land or clear land in some cases. So I don't expect that to slow down. I think that's going to continue to move forward, and we're going to see increased exports. That's why we're focused on the value-added products and the exports of those. But this year, we are going, even though our global market share has dropped due to that competition, we're going to break an all-time record for corn exports in the marketing year that's ending August 31st. We're set to get to 2.75 billion bushels of corn exports. The last time we set a record was in the 2020-21 marketing year, and some very important context there is during that year, which it was, I think, 2.74, so we'll just barely break it. During that year, China accounted for 31% of those corn exports. Today, virtually zero. I think they've taken one vessel or around 37,000 tons of this year's crop. So really neat to see a lot of our traditional customers growing their purchases from us, and some of your non-traditional customers. A lot of non-traditional customers are starting to buy from us.
Are we growing the livestock herd in the world, and is this creating an opportunity?
Livestock herds are growing, with poultry and swine seeing the largest growth. And as we see middle-class income, folks coming into the middle class, being able to afford those animal protein products, that's where we're going to continue to see the growth. And as I mentioned earlier, all those folks are outside our borders, and all that growth is going to happen outside of our borders. And that's why we need to be focused on continuing to export the commodities that we've been doing for 65 years, as well as the value-added products that we're promoting around the globe.
Right. Brazil has overtaken the U.S. as the largest soybean producer in the world. Brazil just came off of what I am told is the mother of all safrina crops, bigger than they've ever harvested before. How much competition is still coming from there, and how does the U.S. gain an advantage over others who have proven they can produce bushels too?
Like I said, it's not going to slow down. They're not only increasing the crop size, they are improving their infrastructure, their port infrastructure, their roads to get to those ports, rail lines, in the case of ethanol, pipelines to the ports to be able to export that ethanol. They're an agricultural powerhouse, and there's no doubt about it. You know, what we can continue to do is rely on our already reliable logistics system, on our timely shipments, our consistency and quality, our market reporting that the U.S. government does that's second to none. We still do have a lot of advantages, and that we're not always going to be the low-cost provider. This year we are, in other years we aren't, but I like our chances going forward. I think the United States and the American farmer has proven decade after decade that they will rise to the occasion and continue to be a formidable competitor in the marketplace.
Are global end users becoming more sensitive to the way that crops are produced?
Yeah, I think it's a trend that we've certainly seen for the last several years and will continue to see. We've got more and more customers asking about how our crops are grown. And we've actually, over the last 2-3 years, we've developed the Corn Sustainability Assurance Protocol, where we issue records of sustainability along with exports. An exporter, United States exporter, can come to our website and get a record of sustainability to go along with his shipment of corn. And we're going to do the same for sorghum soon. And I should back up and say, within that corn, we also offer it for corn gluten meal, for distiller's grains, and co-products. So it's one that customers are starting to ask for. We've even heard rumors of governments starting to require it. We believe this is going to continue. And, we're throughout this process, we're not asking any of American farmers to change their practices. We're just telling the story of the conservation practices that they've been undertaking for decades to conserve their farms for the next generation.
It's never been a major slice of U.S. production or exports. But is there growth in areas for identity-preserved grains?
I think that's tough. The last real volumes that we were doing that with was corn to Japan when they insisted on all non-GM corn. And, you know, you're talking major premiums that have to be paid for that, $30, $40 a ton premium, or maybe even more in some cases. And just the way our system is set up for efficiency today, and with Japan, the last major customer that was demanding that, moving away from the identity preserve, I think you're going to see more of a focus on the sustainability rather than the identity preserve. And also, you know, they are, and other countries are starting to accept the science that's been around for decades, proving that genetically modified technology and genetically modified organisms are completely safe and help us in those conservation and in those sustainability efforts. You can't talk about those two words without GMO in the same sentence.
So we have waited for a new farm bill for a long, long time. The big, beautiful bill did in budget reconciliation provide some support for farmers. But we're still lacking that complete five-year farm bill, and many now suggest there's not much chance for this year, maybe in 2026. Ryan, what's been good about what Congress has provided, but what's still left on the table that has the industry lacking?
You know, certainly we want a farm bill, and we want it soon. We don't, at the Grains Council, we don't get involved in congressional efforts at all, really. We're more focused on working with executive branch where applicable. We don't really get involved in farm bill discussions, but we were a major benefactor of a provision in the Big Beautiful Bill that provided a supplemental fund that virtually doubles the government funding going towards the U.S. cooperator system. We don't know how much yet we as an organization will get, but us and all of the other cooperators will be getting additional funds starting in 2027 to carry out our market development work. We're very excited for that. We know we've all proven, you know, there's a lot of us out there, and you know, USEC, USMEF, USAPEC, many other great organizations that are within the cooperator system, they're going to get more money. We've proven that our work is effective, and it drives real policy changes overseas. It drives additional exports, and we couldn't be happier for this to finally happen for the first time since 2006.
Is it safe to say that additional funds can provide a return on investment, but without that investment, we look at losing to other competitors?
I think that's very safe to say. You know, without growth and expansion in the programs that we're able to do, we will see exports suffer. There's a study out there that shows that the ROI on MAP dollars is 23-1. So really hard to argue with that and see another program that gives that type of return. So with these additional dollars, we fully expect exports to grow and think that they would probably grow a lot less if we weren't to get this expansion.
So you recently have wrapped up your 65th annual meeting of delegates. It was a homecoming, so to speak.
That's right. So last week we had our 65th anniversary Board of Delegates meeting in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We had 19 past chairmen of the board come to that meeting, from dating back all the way to 1995. We had two previous CEOs, Tom Slate and Ken Hobby, were in attendance. It's great to see them as well. And they actually contributed in the meeting and had roles in the meeting and really enjoyed seeing how far the organization has come, you know, how we have evolved to maintain relevance with our new name and the new products that we've been handling for the last several years. Great meeting also to discuss strategy with our current members that are attending all of our meetings today, and really give them a chance to provide input into our strategy, see what progress we've made so far this year, and take a look at what we've got planned for the rest of the year and beyond.
Ryan, I understand the U.S. Grains Council is not involved in lobbying toward policy or, and for that matter, even trade agreements. But in terms of the global marketplace, you are impacted by decisions, not only from Washington, but by other governments around the world. What are pins that you're watching that could fall, that would provide opportunity? Or what are pieces that could fall that would be a major challenge for your efforts to sell grains and bioproducts in the world?
Yeah, I think something we're watching very closely are these trade deals that the Trump administration is negotiating. We have been featured in some of them, like the UK deal, the ethanol deal as part of that trade deal was really good for the American industry. And we're going to be watching others to get the details. We don't have a whole lot of details on all these agreements yet, but what we do know is that USTR has American Ag at the forefront in all these negotiations. They know that agricultural products are really something the United States has to offer in a big way, and particularly the ones at the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council are products that can move into the billions of dollars. So when you're looking at trying to right-size some of these trade agreements, we've got a lot to offer. And so we'll be looking for details in these deals that include corn, barley, sorghum, ethanol, distillers, grains, all the products that we market overseas. And we think that we're going to end up in a pretty good place. We have confidence and we have faith in this administration that they've got our best interests at heart and they're going to drive home some good deals for us.
Well, Ryan LeGrand, we want to thank you for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Congratulations on 65 years of now the U.S. grains and bioproducts. We look forward to the good things that will come from the council in the months and then the years ahead. Ryan, it is Open Mic, and today you've got the last word.
I would say that we greatly appreciate the trust that our members have in us to make a change like this, to maintain relevance in the marketplace in which we operate and change to the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council. I'd also like to thank our public partners at USDA, USTR, and just the entire administration for pushing hard on ag exports. We know it's top of mind for them, and couldn't be happier for the position that we're in today.
Our thanks to Ryan LeGrand, President and CEO of the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Elliott.